Tomorrow is Turkey Day, the day when most of America sits down to some kind of turkey dinner with all the trimmings, but there's a lot about turkeys we may overlook on Thanksgiving Day.
Kyle Cherik is the host of Wisconsin Foodie, and he's here now to give us a Turkey 101. Kyle, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Back at you. So how did we end up eating turkey, of all things, on Thanksgiving Day?
It's a really interesting story, and it came by way of the conquistadors in the 1600s, landing on southern Mexico. And though they were looking for gold, they brought back so many other things that we're now used to that we just take it, you know, we assume are part of the American diet, potatoes and tomatoes and things like that. But the turkey that they encountered was already domesticated, and so they brought it back, spread to Portugal, and then on into what was called the Levant, which was essentially the greater Middle East. It was a French term. And but as early as 1581, England set up the Levant Trading Company to monopolize on the Ottoman Empire and the spices and all the good stuff coming out of there. And by the time, not at Plymouth Rock, but by the time that we get to the early 1700s in America, the turkey had basically become the bird of celebration and large feasts because it was this great domesticated bird that had more yield in meat than pretty much anything else northern Europe had.
And didn't you say that these early turkeys were kind of giant?
Well, the ones, so that's, yeah, the ones that the pilgrims would have encountered in and around Plymouth Rock, the eastern turkey, which is still somewhat of a pure breed, those are Rambo turkeys. Those are 4 feet tall, 30 pounds on average. They look more like descendants from dinosaurs and Jurassic World than they do the kind of turkey that, you know, we think of. Although it's interesting, you know, the average weight of a turkey in 1960 was 16 pounds. The average weight of a turkey that we're going to have on our dining room tables tomorrow is now 30 pounds because of all of the breeding and all of the genetic specificity. It would not be, I don't know how to say it. It would not be wrong to basically call them pathologically obese, the birds that we are now eating on Thanksgiving.
Is there a big taste differential, Kyle, as far as you know?
A big taste differential? Well, I can't speak to it. I mean, this is going back, I don't know how many hundreds of years, right, to the 16th century. I hunt and I adore wild turkey, and it has a very different flavor to it. Not anything like the whiskey, also of the same name. But, you know, a store-bought turkey, I mean, we kind of run the gamut here. So there's that great Saturday Evening Post picture of the turkey dinner. And that, just as Dickens kind of codified Christmas for us, that picture really told America what Thanksgiving should look like and what that celebration was all about. And there's that massive bird in the middle of the table. So the ones that are bred are hybrids of a couple of different breeds, and they're bred to have a huge breast meat and predominantly white meat because that's what the American consumer cared for. Personally, I like the dark, so there's always enough for me. But I would say there is a difference between that and one that is raised on a CSA or a Wisconsin or Midwestern farm. And that's one of the other things. When turkeys are called cage-free, they're all cage-free. I mean, to be cage-free, they only have to be out of doors, and there's some wiggle room there for 51% of the time.
Is there such a thing as a free-range turkey? We hear that word used a lot with chicken.
Oh, sure, definitely. And a free-range is a turkey that was never kept indoors predominantly. So when you pack a bunch of turkeys in together, they get very aggressive. And one of the things that the industry will do, and this is sort of the dark side of our Thanksgiving, but they'll microwave off that first toe so they can still walk, but they really start to peck at each other. They're kept in large houses, and they're kept in low light because that also drops down the aggression label. Hmm. A free-range turkey, you know, I talked to a farmer last week in preparation for this. She's got 40 turkey that come and go on her farm. They eat the grains that she feeds them, the worms that are in the ground, the bugs, that sort of thing. And she had just slaughtered and froze all of them. She said, we had no problem with avian flu because we don't use antibiotics and we feed our turkeys essentially like they would be in the wild, though their life is so good here that they don't fly away.
Wow.
You know,
so that's a real free-range turkey.
Open.
voluntary turkey almost. Right. So you talked about some of the different flavor profiles when you look at maybe a more commercially bred turkey versus one that's maybe more like the ones you described who choose to stay there. What is the difference in taste?
I think it's more rich. I think that there's a sense of iron in a good way, not like a you know, cut of liver, which I'm not a big fan of, but a sense of iron that's in their blood and that's in the meat. A free-range turkey, and there's so many different breeds, but a free-range turkey in general is going to taste more like dark meat that the American palate would know and less like that super clean antibiotics, never let anything else have a choice but grow that big white breast, you know, kind of flavor.
Now, you were mentioning earlier how turkeys had become the bird of celebration for some from early settlers from Europe. Mm-hmm. And to me, that sounds like a tall order. I feel like turkeys are really hard to cook. It's hard to know when they're done. It's hard to make it so it's not dried out. And some parts are completely desiccated and other parts are edible. So, I mean, Imagine the cooking tools. They didn't have the pop-up meat thermometers back then. So how do you do this thing right?
I think the paradigm is also important. The way that a turkey would have been cooked through much of the celebration would have probably been on a spit, right? Or would have been in a large stone, you know, the same oven that would have baked bread and things like that. So slow and low like barbecue. The skin would have been crispy, but everything else would have been delicious. You know, for us, I mean, we just go with the classic Cook's Illustrated recipe. Peter Kimball is my spirit animal when it comes to cooking things like that. And, you know, he and his folks have spent more time and energy researching it than NASA did on getting someone to the moon. So we kind of abide by that. The one thing that we don't do is put the stuffing inside the bird because you're either bound to have a dried out bird or undone stuffing, in which case if you use eggs in the stuffing, you know, then your friend Sam Manila is coming to the dinner as well. It's really hard to get the interior of a bird that is now, that's the other thing, these enormous birds, it's hard to heat up the stuffing on the inside. When they were 16 pounds or smaller, it wasn't that hard, you know, something more like a goose. So we've sort of gotten away within the tradition of the stuffing inside the bird. What we like to do is actually cook it halfway and then cut it into large pieces, lay those over the stuffing, put it back in the oven, and then all that yummy turkey juice goodness seeps down into the stuffing, makes the dried cherries that we use taste delicious. And, you know, we miss the Norman Rockwell moment, but we're eating this. We're not taking pictures.
Well, happy turkey eating, Kyle.
Thank you. You too.
Kyle Cherik is the host of Wisconsin Foodie.